Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve! How you doing, sir?
Man, this is a taped episode. It's a mailbag episode. Everybody going on vacation. Let's get this going.
Well, not the usual intro. Steve is correct. We are going strictly mailbag, so quick apologies to any news that we may miss over the next few days. But it has been quite a while, Steve, since we've actually done a mailbag episode. So it was funny for me. It's kind of going back through the Dunker Spot email, which, again, you can always send your basketball thoughts and questions to dunkerspot@yahoo.com. But going through some of these, it's like, huh, this is some good stuff. Then we got a few from Twitter as well. So I think we have a pretty versatile mailbag for you. Again, we will return and catch up on any news that we may miss over the weekend, et cetera, et cetera. But without further ado, let's tap in. Oh, actually, first, before getting into the mailbag officially, wanted to get into some quick news items that naturally dropped right after we finished recording the most recent episode of The Dunker Spot. And you know that made me happy if you've been following the pod for a while. So first, the All-Summer League teams were announced. On the first team was Neat Clifford of the Sacramento Kings, who did a little bit of everything very smooth. Honestly, should have talked about him on the last episode of The Dunker Spot during the Summer League section, but super smooth shot creator, showed some interesting playmaking flashes as well. But field about score, he makes the first team, represent the Sacramento Kings. Kyle Filipowski, who was your Summer League MVP. David Jones Garcia of the San Antonio Spurs, who got all the buckets and ultimately earned himself a two-way contract with the Spurs. Jordan Miller, who is just a Summer League superstar at this point. And Terrence Shannon Jr. of the Minnesota Timberwolves. And for your second team, it was Ron Holland of the Detroit Pistons. Isaac Jones, also of the Sacramento Kings. Con Canipolo of the Charlotte Hornets, your championship-winning Charlotte Hornets. AJ Mitchell of the Oklahoma City Thunder, and KG Simpson, also of the championship winning Charlotte Hornets. So congrats to all 10. We talked about most of those players in the most recent episode of the Dunker Spot. So if you want to check out our Summer League section, you still can. And then quickly on the signing front, the Rockets signing Josh Okogie to a one-year deal. The Spurs also signing Lindy Waters to a one-year deal. So some interesting depth pieces, more on the shooting side and general movement side for the Spurs. Certainly the defensive depth and a little bit of offensive glass crashing for Josh Okogie as well. So we'll see if they end up ultimately making the final rosters, but wanted to get those news nuggets in. And again, we'll be doing a little bit of catch up on the next episode of the Dunker Spot on the news front. So stay tuned on that front. To the Dunker Spot mailbag, a quick thank you to those who sent in questions and continue to send those in. We will still sprinkle in mailbag episodes throughout the summer, but we start with the regular. We start with Anthony, who says, "Greetings, Nikias and Steve. Hope all is well with you gentlemen and hope you guys are having a great summer. Continued success and keep cooking." Thank you, Anthony. Got a pair of questions. Number one, following this NBA season that just concluded, what was your big and or small takeaway in the league's philosophy and in your own coverage of it?
I mean, league philosophy wise, a lot more teams getting up and down the floor, a lot of pace, a lot of tempo, not a ton of set plays, teams having to trust their base on both ends, partially because of the grind of the season, partially because of a lack of practice time. I think you need a lot of versatility to get where you need to be. I think this year reminded that identity is important and being able to navigate and work through that is important. You need lineup versatility to be able to navigate through the season and navigate through the playoffs. You need a version of depth, but I think the key is the trio of identity, versatility, and depth all tie in together to elevate you. And yeah, I think you kind of need all three, or at least two out of three, to kind of get where you want to go. I think you need multiple ways to be able to get back to being yourself, or, you know, be able to pivot in the playoffs.
Okay, I like that. I think broader strokes for me, to bounce off of what you said, Steve, just an even louder example of there are multiple pathways to build a good slash winning basketball team. And so just watching this year's playoffs and to see the Thunder were obviously excellent all year long. The Pacers were very good for most of the season and they were elite at the turn of the calendar. But like watching different types of playoff teams have success. Like the Knicks didn't look like the Pacers, didn't look like the Nuggets, didn't look like the Thunder, et cetera. Just kind of further drove that point home. And to bounce off of your lineup versatility point, like the general rise of teams going with double bigs was interesting to me. It's not a new concept at all, of course, but, you know, watching the Thunder and what they tried to do with Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein, watching the Cavaliers once again as they build more chemistry with the new core with Evan Mobley and Jared Allen. Seeing Houston sprinkle in Alperen Şengün and Steven Adams out there together and going zone and what the openings they tried to carve out on offense. But watching just the general rise of two big lineups and the importance of that, and it kind of bleeds into, as you mentioned, Steve, just the overall importance of lineup versatility. I think that was an interesting one for me. So that's something I'm going to be paying more attention to moving forward, just to see like how that progresses or what kind of things shift on that front. I'm trying to think.
Okay. Is it a rise of two big lineups, or did teams just find success with it?
I feel like a little bit of yes. I feel like we saw more double big than we saw last year.
I think he just had better double big lineups. Y'all hated the Pistons for like 4 years.
Well,
you didn't believe in the Miami Heat, so.
Well, that's true. I guess, I mean, the Heat did also try to cycle through. Like, I guess you could mention the Bam and Khalil Ware pairing.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
it depends on the night you caught him. You saw the outline of how it could be successful.
Double big lineups only work if the two bigs have skill sets that are aligned with each other, mm-hmm. or they're really good defensively.
And ideally both. And so again, I want to see how that progresses. Like, do we see Miami lean more into that? Like, I'm sure that the early shot is going to be, let's see what Khalil and Bam could do with a larger sample. But if it doesn't work for whatever reason, if it is the Bam jumper, if it's the Khalil Ware jumper, as teams largely didn't care about Khalil Ware on the perimeter, for example, like how quickly do they pivot? But those are some of the things that kind of pop for me. So I guess that's what I would say on that front. And I think as it relates to my own coverage, aside from a general, this is interesting, let me track this moving forward to see if it's really a thing or if this is team specific, I think one thing in evaluating my analysis and even with just the pods themselves, like I'm still trying to strike the balance between like having conviction with my takes or my thoughts while still leaving room for, I don't think this will work, or I don't like this, but I see how it could type beat. Because I feel earlier in my quote unquote career, it was very much, this is what I think, and I'll be either right or my wrong. And I have expanded more to, okay, I see how this can happen. And so I'm just trying to find a little bit more of a better balance, because I feel like I lost a little bit of the conviction this year.
I don't think you lost the conviction at all.
Fair enough.
Not a single bit.
Not a single bit. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you didn't stay in all business, but that's a different story for a different time.
Okay.
I think part of that is kind of a trend of where things are leaning, where it's right or wrong, as opposed to what a team can and can't do. And so for me, I don't think I've changed much as far as what I'm looking for or what I'm trying to talk about or what I'm trying to point out. I don't know where to put it sometimes because of this world we kind of live in where conviction take, I don't like this, so this is bad, or new trend is the best thing ever, or consistent tennis matches on certain subjects and narratives and all this good stuff, foul drawing and all these trends. Now everyone wants to talk about full court pressure, forgetting what the counter is to full court pressure. Everyone wants to talk about double big lineups, forgetting that not all double big lineups work. Everyone wants to talk about defense, not understanding how and why teams are good defensively. Everyone wants to talk about a copycat league, not understanding that the best teams can sustain offense. There are these trends I feel like I have to poke at. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of poking at trends.
I feel that.
It's a tiring way of talking about basketball. And maybe that type of analysis is extinct. You know what I mean? Maybe it's just time for narratives and agendas and stats and numbers. And we just put a stamp on a team around the league and that's it. Clippers, old, boom, out of here. Cavs can't get it done. Magic can't get it done. That was the thing that got me last year. It felt like there was a dwindling number of teams that people actually believed in to be capable to win anything. Hmm. So it's like, okay, well, I'm going to point it out, but at the same time, I'm not sure you're understanding what the pathway is for this team to have success. And I don't know if you want to understand what the pathway is for this team to have success. If you write off half the league within the first 30 days,
you can only talk about the other half, and then you're going to end up writing them off too as you see more things.
So that is where it got tricky coverage-wise. I'm always going to look at the regular season and learn and understand a team and see what could hurt them, what could elevate them, what makes them good, what they struggle with, and then see how that develops. Just really felt like the noise came. The noise and the stamps were loud with these teams and these players.
No, I think that's fair. And like to that point, that's not a fun world to live in or operate in. And the point that you make all the time, Steve, and I agree with you, like it can be incredibly limiting if you are immediately saying this is it or this is not it. And then just kind of leaving it there. And so like have your thought, but kind of leave room for that thought to expand with new information. And so to your earlier point, like I don't think that type of analysis is or should go extinct. Like, I think it is still very important. And you are the best at doing it. So like, I certainly don't want you to like dial back on that front, but I can also understand the frustration in operating in that space while combating, as you mentioned, like the noise.
But why, man? You got these numbers and these stats, and that way you can be an expert on your team because no one else watches your team. You see, so then I could talk about my team in an expert fashion and tell you why this doesn't work. And because it didn't work with my team, it certainly won't work anywhere else. Mm. On to the next thing.
Yeah, I don't think that's how you should go about it. I don't think that's a healthy way to push forward basketball conversations.
Hey, man, well, y'all got AI me on this pod. Don't get mad.
No. I will absolutely get mad. Don't you speak that evil on me, Ricky Bobby. Absolutely not. But to the second portion of the Anthony question, have you found the second apron a bit of an excuse for teams to duck really going all in? I'll hang up and listen.
I don't think it's an excuse for teams to duck going all in. I think it's a shift for how teams go all in, when teams go all in, how long teams go all in for. I think teams are trying to figure out the best way to do it. I absolutely think that this shortens your window. Like, I think championship contending windows are getting shorter and shorter. How you construct the roster, and if you do it a certain way, it's shorter and shorter. Like, you have to pivot quickly. And I think it's a point that Bobby Marks has written about, talked about, spoken on, and the amount of teams that went all in before the second apron really hit. Phoenix, Boston, Bucks, Clippers, right? Mm. All those teams have made more moves after the moves they made. Because, oh my, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. Like, and the Clippers still have James Harden, right? Guess who they don't have? Paul George.
This is true.
So you're having to kind of make these decisions roster-wise. Okay, how good is this? How long can we do this? Can we go for it in a different way that will keep us away from this? It's just, it's costly to not just go in the second apron, but stay in the second apron. I think that's the thing. So I think you're going to see teams that are willing to go in it for a year, willing to dance around it for a year, but you got to get that payoff. Mm-hmm. You look at Boston. Boston was looking at this like, hey, this is really going to be a thing. And then Jason Tatum unfortunately got hurt, and they're like, well, time to pack it up. Think mm-hmm. about that reality.
Yeah. The Boston Celtics, who recently won a title, like, and which even before the Tatum injury, like, you kind of had the understanding, like, all right, at least one of Drew or Kristaps are probably going to be out of here. Tatum goes down, and it's just a Kristaps, enjoy Atlanta, Drew, enjoy Portland. It's like, okay, well, this is drastic, and they may not be done on top of that. Like, I don't know if Anthony Simons is going to be there past the trade deadline, for example. Like, to the literal question, like, if I'm reading the chart right here, like, I think there are only three teams that are technically hard capped at the second apron heading into next season, at least right now. And you have a little bit of wiggle room before you actually hit that maximum number. And so, like, in a literal sense, like, not a lot of teams are in danger. But, like, I wouldn't say it's an excuse because, you, as Steve mentioned, like, you don't want to live in that reality. And to the actual second apron restrictions themselves, you get to the second apron, you can't really go all in even if you want to. Like, you're a second apron team, you can't sign buyout folks, you can't aggregate contracts, you can't do sign and trade. Like, even if you want, you're willing to spend and you want to continue spending, your draft picks frozen like 7 years out, like you are literally stuck. Like, your hands are tied. And because of those restrictions, I don't think and I could be wrong. This could be me just being naive, but like, I don't think a team would like strategically spend enough to get to the second apron and then stay low enough in it so they have the excuse to not spend more. Because other teams are also trying to navigate their own finances, you don't really have the same get out of jail free will. We're just going to dump this contract elsewhere to get out of here, like an easy button, like you could in years past. Not that contract dumping and stuff like that doesn't still exist, but you certainly can't do it with the same volume. You can't do it with the same freedom with how many picks are tied up. And again, the restrictions that come with the first apron too, but especially that second apron. So like, I don't think it's a big issue right now in terms of like it being an excuse for teams. I think it's a very real thing. Like, we got the offhand Jokic comment, you know, not too long ago.
Yeah. I still think teams will go for it when the chance is there, but I think it's got to be the right spot. Like, you think in an honest conversation, you think Minnesota wanted to make that cat trade when they made it?
No, like, they're coming off of the coming off the conference final. Like, nah, we ain't trying to do that.
Do they want to let Nikhil Alexander Walker just walk to Atlanta?
No.
You look at Orlando. Do you feel like they made all-in moves this summer?
We're going to be circling back in a year and a half. Like, we playing Suggs, Bane, Paolo, and Franz. How much now?
Yeah, they did a thing. So I'll just keep it there. Stay tuned.
There we go. Stay tuned indeed. All right. Next pair of questions is going to come from our dear pal, Matt, from the Dunker Spot Watch Parties and other platforms. So appreciate you, Matt. Question for both of us individually, Steve, but naturally we will both chime in. But first, hi, Nikias and Duncan. Fair enough.
None of those people are me.
Oh, just you wait. Just wait to the next one. I've had this thought on my mind for a while as I'm starting to pick up on why people are doing things on the court. With both of your guidance being a huge part of my feeling, somewhat able to do so, my mind is turning more and more to how to counter, in general terms, what we see most prominent in the game today. What shifts are we going to see next? Like, as I see it, today's game, with some exception, is lots of pick and rolls to get separation, offenses that typically spread at least four out to the three-point line or at least have a non-shooter as a hub, defense that seems painfully difficult to play to counter this, and generally stuff that would make Charles Barkley from 15 years ago very angry. I'm not saying that everyone plays the same way, but there are hallmarks to present-day gameplay just as there have been in every prior era. Maybe there are better ones than the few I listed. I'm wondering where you guys see the game going next. Is there a shift you're seeing? Will defense lead the offense or the other way around? Are there rule changes forthcoming that you see guiding the evolution one way or another?
Go ahead, Nikias and Duncan.
I guess I am Nikias and also Duncan. Like, I think it's been cool to kind of watch the league shift from, if you've got a really good big slash, if you just generally have size, you're going to win, to like the Warriors era, which I still feels like people missed it a little bit. I think it was just small ball. It was more about these skills that kind of complement each other as they went to smaller lineups. But you need a big hulking center that can win games for you. Now you need to be able to go small. And if you don't have a team that can shift to go small and switch everything, you're in trouble. And then now that has now bolted back up to some of the double big alignments that we're seeing. And just in general, a level of lineup versatility that every team sees. So like watching those kind of ebbs and flows and in general, understanding what those ebbs and flows actually are, has probably been the most fun that I've had in trying to gauge what exactly is happening with the NBA and where is it and where things are going on that front. And so for me, like, I'm curious to see on the defensive portion first. Steve already alluded to like the full court pressure a little bit earlier, but like there are a handful of teams that have the super high pickup points that have the earnest full court pressure and not just the we're up here and then we're backing off. Like, do we actually see that become an actual trend, or is that just going to be team/personnel specific? Is that just going to be a way for them to take a little bit of time off the clock, give our defense a little bit more of a chance? I think in light of, you know, as you mentioned, pick and rolls in the question, like, worth noting, last couple of years, overall pick and roll rate across the league has gone down a little bit. It's still higher than what it was like 10 years ago and stuff like that. But you are seeing that shift down a little bit more. Something that Steve points out all the time is, you know, certain teams going to more pass and cut and just wanting to see more of that. Do we see more of that as a counter in light of teams kind of seeing the earlier pick and roll, spread pick and roll revolution and saying, fine, we're going to switch everything so y'all don't have those openings? Like, do we see more of the pass and cut? Do we see more of just the general hub work as a kind of a counter to that, to open up more cutting, open up more movement, is that a back and forth that we're going to see more of moving forward? Those are probably my immediate thoughts on that front. Steve, I'd be curious to get your input on this.
Well, I mean, I think it's everything ebbs and flows. The game always evolves. A lot of concepts remain the same. Offenses are always going to look to create an advantage. Defenses are always going to look to take it away. So you mentioned full court pressure. Not every team can do it the right way. You can just get the ball to a person that the other team doesn't really want to press, or you get it to your center, or you set double pick and rolls. Like, there are counters to that. I think defensively, there's a lot of different things that they can try and do. The issue is zone has gone up and down. It hasn't been a hard answer. Sometimes can be very effective, but not everyone can play a good zone because not everyone can stay matched up. So you end up with the same problems of being in rotation. I think it's more just how can defenses find a way to keep offenses out of rhythm, find a way to sustain. And maybe that means pulling back on the aggression and trying to stay solid. You know, a lot of times we criticize teams for sticking with their base, but if teams are going to go heavy pick and roll, we're pointing at certain players and saying, here's a drop. Here's a switch. We don't believe that this is an advantage for you. And so, you know, offenses, again, because they're committed to moving the ball, will move it and get somewhere else or try and find the different attacks. But I think the other part with offenses is you got to remember there's the high level of skill that's in this league and a lot of things that are inverted to always find a pressure point. You know, even if you defend the first action, you know, that might happen in the first 5 seconds of the clock. Now it's okay. Which part of your defense do you not think can guard this action? How can we use misdirection to get your weak side defense out of position? Can we use, you know, our guards as screeners, wings and forwards initiating offenses, centers as hubs? So there's always a way right now for offenses to poke at defenses at some point within the possession. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't even include transition defense or being able to push and get quick shots up. And so I think it's one of those things where I think defenses take a hit because of less practice time. Like, there's less time to put more things in. There's less time to really lock certain things in from game to game, if that makes sense. You kind of have to stick to your base and try and adjust on the fly. And so I think defenses will try to sustain more. We saw more unders on handoffs and screens this year at times. More teams were willing to mix that in than before. But all this stuff cycles, all the archetypes cycle. You go from not liking point guards who can't make plays and can't shoot the ball to wishing every team had a true point guard. You go from not liking the rim rolling big and thinking that's an archaic player, and now they're featured in your double big lineups and still thriving. You know, you go from 3-and-D being all the rage to, well, what else can they do?
Can you dribble? You kind of need the dribble.
Everyone wants a shooter. Well, what else? What can they be to close out? These things go back and forth. Everyone's down on the scoring guard archetype until their team can't score. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Just keep that in the back of mind. A lot of evolution there, but I think it's also just a lot of things shift, things change. A lot of guys are asked and can do different things in a way that we haven't necessarily seen before this era to a degree. So it's hard. It's hard to defend.
It is hard to defend. I like that answer, Steve. Very quickly, I was trying to pull up like the last 5 years, trying to get some season averages on the zone front and on the full court pressure front. And so looking at, you know, to your zone point about it kind of ebbing and flowing, in the 2020-2021 season, about 2.6% of defensive possessions were in zone. Next year, that's up to 2.7. 22-23, that was up to 3%. 23-24, that dropped down to 2.7%. And then this past year, up to 2.8%. So it's still around the same bracket on that front. And so just to get the kind of the full court slash backcourt pressure gauge, back in 2020-21, that's about 9.4% of possessions. The following year, 10.4% of possessions. The year after that, 10.4% of possessions again. In 2023-24, that's 12.2% of possessions. So that jumped up. And then last year, another jump up to 15.2% of possessions there. So you're seeing the rise there. The zone is kind of ebbing and flowing. And so as your overall point, Steve, just there is going to be an ebb and flow, and just in general, players have to evolve. Like, you have to become more skilled, et cetera. Like, I think that's going to progress. And so I am excited to see, like, what kind of change that garners with that kind of evolution. But, no, I think it's fun stuff. Did you have any closing thoughts or anything else you wanted to add before we move?
Nope.
All righty. Well, to the second Matt question. Dear Steve Jones and Jr., I was watching a podcast breaking down the Indiana Pacers game to comeback, and it was mentioned how Pascal Siakam had a bad game, and it seemed like the kind of thing that was inexplicable from the outside. Maybe he wasn't feeling well, maybe he didn't like the way he was being involved, etc. My question is, when players seem to have a bad game out of nowhere, how often can people around the team see that coming? I don't mean having knowledge of an injury or illness necessarily, but like knowing someone left shoot around pissed off, or someone has a family thing going on, or these two players don't like each other at the moment. How frequently, when it's reported player X had a bad game, shots just didn't fall, are you in the locker room before the game thinking about said player, it is not going to go well tonight? I promise this question isn't gambling related. I'm just curious about how much of the stuff that seems unpredictable from the outside actually makes complete sense when you get up close.
I mean, see if I can attack this the right way. I mean, it's you never really doubt your guys on the inside, but that's not really a thing you could or should do. That's going to be sniffed out very quickly, and it's not going to go well for you. You know, so you just really can't have that mindset. But I mean, the biggest thing I would remind people of, one, there is an entire staff and roster dedicated to making you have a bad day. So I know that wasn't the bulk of the question, but just a reminder, like that's, we're trying to make you have a bad game, but that's kind of our job. Two, these folks are human beings, you know, just like we have good and bad days, good work days and bad work days, that just kind of happens. And so I think the human element is to just try and manage that person and help them get to the best place possible. And like human nature is always going to kick in. We see it every time when a starter or starters are out and you just see a little bit of a natural letdown. It changes your prep. It changes how guys are thinking. It changes the effort level. It changes what you're attacking. Changes what they're doing. Schedule starts getting you a little bit. You got to fight through it, figure it out. You know, you look at a stretch and be like, okay, we got to manage this, figure this out. Like those are things you think about and discuss. Those things happen throughout the season. Any sort of like beef stuff, I mean, they're grown adults. A, that's going to happen when you spend an ungodly amount of time around each other.
True.
You're around each other all the time for months and months on end. There's going to be moments of silence or conflict to a degree, but you're grownups. You figure it out. Sometimes the easiest thing is take some space. You know, sometimes the easiest thing is have a conversation. It just kind of depends. So whenever you see that, I don't look at it and be like, oh, man, we're in trouble. It's like, ooh, let me grab him real quick. Let's see. Can they be on different buses for a second? You know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff. But then again, it's basketball. So, I mean, two people can have that kind of beef and then go to lunch right after and then like nothing happened. I know it happened to me in high school and college. Want to fight people and then sitting there eating teriyaki chicken.
The beauty of sports.
It's just, it kind of is what it is. From a staff or coaching perspective, that's where the relationship building is important. So you kind of know the ups and downs and how to speak or reach out to that individual to help them process stuff. But I mean, you could tell if the nap didn't hit or phone calls too long or illness or any of that stuff. But on the other side, you've seen guys who can barely walk or talk or going through something go out and do an amazing thing. So it's just kind of an up and down thing. My mind was always on the opponent. So did someone say something to make the opponent mad? Whether it was our team, our press, or their press, like, did something happen to bother them? It's like, oh, okay, this could get interesting. Or if you're a defensive player and your matchup is not a high-quality play, okay, oof, how's that going to look? Those are more the concerns than just, like, purely mental beef stuff.
Okay. I liked it. It's good stuff and good insight from Steve. So we appreciate you for that one, good sir. To the next one. This is going to come from Justin, who says, hey, Nikias and Steve. Hello. Longtime listener, greatly appreciative of all that you both do to give great intel to NBA fans. My question is, the Celtics clearly are in a flux state with Tatum likely out for the year and a salary crunch coming for 2025-26. This was a question that was sent in a little bit before the offseason started to give that little bit of context. Of the talent that they have on the roster that are not hot button trade topics, i.e. Drew and KP, who were both eventually moved, and aren't established starters, like Jaylen Brown and Derek White, who are still there, is there anyone you're excited to see perform in greater roles in the upcoming season? And if so, where do you think they can contribute in Joe Mazzulla's offensive strategy?
I mean, I'm excited to see where Joe Mazzulla pivots style-wise. Is there a greater emphasis on defense? Do we see more movement offensively because you can't purely rest on matchup hunting? How do they kind of reshape themselves on the fly? I think the flip side of this for Boston is this is a person who hasn't been afraid to turn to different guys at different times. It's not like he's been afraid to play different bigs. Like, obviously, you lose Luke Kornet, but we've seen him play Nemus Kata. You know what I mean? We've seen Shireman play. We've seen Peyton Pritchard rise. We've seen Sam Hauser rise. So we've seen these guys kind of be put in different positions. What kind of boat does he build around those guys having to take another step up? That gets interesting. But it's more like, to me, okay, does Jordan Walsh step up into a different position? Does he now elevate? Does Hugo Gonzalez get an opportunity? Like, I have an expectation and understanding what Pritchard and Hauser can do, and I kind of know what he wants to see from his bigs. So I'm not as concerned with who the person is. I know what they're going to be asked to do.
Yeah.
So, like, George Ding is going to be asked to do certain things. All their bigs have played before at some point. They're going to be asked to do certain things. It's going to make sense to them. But what are the lineup combinations? What are the pressure points? How do they try and sustain on both ends of the floor? Because a lot of the built-in things aren't there anymore. But there are moments for Boston when they had guys out, you know, into the season, we're playing Charlotte. None of our guys are playing, you know? So it's something they've had to navigate in moments. Now it's just kind of who you are to a degree. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have to attack and play with a little bit of a different mindset on both ends. I just kind of want to see what that looks like.
Okay, I like it. I think my immediate thought was, and it's very much the easy button to this question, but my first thought was, we're just going to get unleashed Peyton Pritchard. And that is going to be a... we're going to see an extension of the Peyton Pritchard experience. I guess it's the more accurate way to put it. But yeah, like, I would imagine, like, he's probably just going to start at this point.
This is Anthony Simons erasure.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, he's been there longer. Like, I could obviously see Anthony Simons starting if he's on the opening day roster. But, like, I just thought that he had, like, the seniority, et cetera, et cetera.
See what I mean about that conviction?
What you mean?
You still got it.
Anywho, the initial thought for me was Peyton Pritchard. As I was looking up some Peyton Pritchard Boston numbers ahead of the podcast, the Boston Celtics logged 418 minutes with Peyton Pritchard on the floor without Drew Holiday, Jason Tatum, Al Horford, or Kristaps Porzingis on the floor. And so naturally, Tatum out for the year, Drew and Porzingis on different teams. Al Horford, is he going to sign with Golden State at any point over the next week? Like, what is the holdup on that if he's actually going to do that? But anyway, 418 minutes with Peyton on without those four who are not expected to be on the roster / in the rotation this year. Boston had nearly a plus 13 net rating in those minutes. Peyton Pritchard had a 62 true shooting percentage in those minutes, converted 67% of his twos, shot 38% from three on high volume. With an extended run, I would imagine the efficiency is going to drop a little bit because it'd be kind of hard for it not to in light of the defensive pressure he's going to see and things like that. But he has showcased over the last couple of years, if he's asked to start because somebody's out, et cetera, he is more than willing to take on more on-ball onus. And so a full season of that is going to be interesting to me. I'm curious to see what his actual numbers are going to be and what his actual impact is going to be in light of those numbers and in light of that role usage jumping a little bit. Beyond him, I had Jordan Walsh in my notes. You already touched on that portion. The other thing that I had, as you mentioned, Sam Hauser as well, is do we see, to make the quick comparison, like, do we see the Duncan Robinson like leap in terms of the driving and the passing? Where we saw Duncan turn from really good shooter / movement shooter to guy that can read two on the ball, make these slip in these passes on time, on target. We saw last year with Duncan Robinson became a much better driver overall. And so, like, do we see those kind of, I don't want to call them micro skills because they're very important, but like, do we see leaps there in addition to what Sam already provides as a shooter and, like, you know, him just generally being solid defensively already? So I think he's going to get the minutes. So I'm kind of looking for those two things with those wings. But yeah, like, Peyton Pritchard, if he's just getting like 31 minutes a night, that could get funny. And I want to see what that looks like. All right. Any closing Celtics thoughts before we move to a fun pick'em of sorts?
You're good.
All right. This one coming from Alan, who says, If you were going to build an 8-man roster with the best defense possible being your only goal, we're not considering offense in any way, and you can only use players drafted after 2001, what does your roster look like? And Allen gives the roster. Allen's roster is Drew Holiday, OG Anunoby, Jaden McDaniels, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Rudy Gobert, Alex Caruso, Danny Green, and Robert Covington. And so it wasn't specifically said in the question, but I would assume that these are the peak versions of these players. But Drew, OG, Jaden McDaniels, Giannis, Rudy, Alex Caruso, Danny Green, and Robert Covington is a pretty strong top eight, Steve. So I'll turn it over to you. Who were your eight, and who else were you considering before you whittled it down to your eight?
Well, I took this question entirely too seriously.
Okay.
And fell down a rabbit hole. I assumed that this meant I was getting the peak version of this player and went with that.
Okay.
So my Alex Caruso did not make my list because he was not drafted. So I took that literally.
That's fair. Okay.
I have Drew Holiday.
Okay.
Tony Allen.
Mm-hmm.
LeBron James.
Mm-hmm.
Draymond Green.
Okay.
Mark Gasol.
Got you.
Jimmy Butler.
Ooh.
Kawhi Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
Victor Wembanyama.
Oh, you went Wimby. That's fun. That is fun.
Yeah, good luck scoring against this team. Yeah, if I have this ordered correctly, I think my toughest submissions, Bam Adebayo, was on my team until I kept going. Kevin Durant was a tough omission. Okay. Andre Iguodala. Pete Clay, Pete Dwight Howard, Pete Anthony Davis. I had a thought about Derek White. I had PJ Tucker, Nick Batum, Avery Bradley, Matisse Thybulle.
Okay.
Herb Jones, Derek White, Amen Thompson.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's my eight. I don't know how you're going to deal with that. That's just a lot of size and effort and activity.
Oh, I think that's fire. I kind of want to change one of my guards now in light of the like Caruso wasn't drafted piece.
Read the directions.
That's a good shout. And so luckily I have my honorable mentions like listed next to the position group. So what I did is I also wanted to try to get a good list together. 8-man rotation, I decided to divide this into guards, wings, forwards, and bigs. And so I wanted to get two apiece. That's how I wanted to go about it. And so with all due respect to Alex Caruso, who wasn't drafted, I would just go to my first alternate on the guard spot. Which means...
You can't take him off?
I mean, he would have been there. I'm just saying that. No, that's a fair... I am Mr. Requirement in games played, and this is the letter of the law, et cetera. I think that's a fair shot. That's good work from you. So my guards were Drew Holiday and Alex Caruso, but in light of Caruso technically being ineligible, next person up is Marcus Smart for me in the guard room. So I have Drew Holiday and Marcus Smart. And some of the other guards that I considered, Chris Paul, Chris Dunn, Dyson Daniels.
Chris Paul?
Indeed.
Over Tony Allen?
Just wait. No, not over Tony Allen. In the wings group.
Over Mike Conley?
Yes. But in the wings group.
All right.
I have Kawhi Leonard and Tony Allen. In the forward group. I'll go over the honorable mentions. But in the forward group, I have Draymond Green. I also have Ben Simmons. And in the big group, I have Rudy Gobert and Bam Adebayo. And as far as honorable mentions go, Andre Iguodala, Herb Jones, who you mentioned, Amen Thompson, as you mentioned. Andre Roberson was a guy I want to give a shout to, especially since we're not considering offense at all. That brother just got after it, pre-injury and all that good stuff. In the forward group, LeBron James, Giannis, Shane Battier was a guy that I gave a shout to, drafted in 01. And so I had an asterisk there because I was like, ooh, does it have to start with the 02 draft or is that like, is the 01 draft like literally the latest one? Because if so, then Shane Battier, if not, you can take him off. You mentioned Anthony Davis. I also had Wimby as an honorable mention. Had Dwight Howard on my list as well. Also had Evan Mobley on my list. Also had Marc Gasol on my list, which I'm sure you got a chuckle out of, but had Gasol down as an honorable mention as well. But that's where I landed. Holiday and Smart. Smart in place of Alex Caruso since he wasn't drafted. Sorry. Kawhi and Tony Allen. Draymond Green and Ben Simmons, who at this point we are far removed from him finishing, I think, second in Defensive Player of the Year voting, and where he's incredibly large and like legitimately defending guards and naturally had the size to defend forwards as well. Just, he was just insane at the peak of his powers. Rudy Gobert and Bam as your bigs.
No respect for Jimmy Butler.
Jimmy was incredibly good. That's a good shout from you. Like he still wouldn't have made my top eight, but I probably should have at least written his name down. So I'll give you that one. But that's where I land. I also appreciated the Robert Covington shot. So I go back to Allen's list. Because I don't think that is a name that many would have brought up but at the peak of his powers, Philly slash you. He was incredibly good. Or at least off the ball he was. So I like it. I like it. All right. Next one going to come from Michael. Her next pair, rather. First time emailer here. Big fan of the podcast and all your content. Love all the analysis and love the insight you provide to someone who's not able to catch games on the regular due to European timetables. So, had a couple of questions for the mailbags. Number one, I'm always fascinated by the progression of the league and how they embrace and maximize different concepts. And after watching some analysis videos, such as those from Ben Taylor of the Thinking Basketball YouTube channel, quick shout out Ben, I keep encountering concepts that are introduced as novelties in the NBA, such as peel or early switches, or a lot of rotation concepts. But I feel like I've encountered these many times growing up in low-level high school hoops in Europe. How is it that these concepts spread? Is it just teams showing proof of concept in the NBA? Is it as a response to offenses becoming better and better, or a secret third thing?
I mean, you can go back to the Spurs and the way they started to embrace the style and substance of that brand of basketball, and their success led to more people doing it. And obviously more players came over with that mindset, that skill, offense, free flowing, moving the ball. Having more people with more skill means you can do more things. So I just think it was a gradual influence, in my opinion, over time. And the games are still different. They have their, you know, there's more of an influence in the NBA. There's still some differences as far as some of the quick shots. Not all the defensive rotations are the same. Some of the rotations you do over there, you can't do over here anymore. Mm-hmm. Some of the ones you try over here doesn't work as well because they don't have the same nuance. So it's a little different. But I would just say gradual influence over time.
Okay. I'm right there with you. And I would just say on a general note, teams and coaches are like seeking this stuff out. Like they're watching a bunch of basketball. They're trying to draw influence from everywhere. Like not directly related to what you said, but like when I read the question, the first thing that I thought about was like Miami following the Dallas Mavericks championship of 2011 and all that stuff happened. The story that came out, I want to say like early in that next season, where it's a story about Eric Spoelstra going to visit Oregon and Chip Kelly just to garner different ideas for the offense and stuff like that. And I'm just like, this is the kind of like soul seeking and information seeking that I think NBA staffs generally want to get to anyway. And so when you do have, you know, more international players coming over and some of the style influences permeating the NBA, their success had in the NBA, teams are like, ooh, well, we got to beat that team. We either need to do what they do better or find direct counters to it, et cetera. It all just kind of flows within itself. So a little bit of overlap with what Steve said, but those were my quick thoughts on that front. And number two, on a more personal note, do you have any memories of any role player's super specific tendencies, mannerisms, ability or inability at a specific skill that you watched growing up which stand out to you?
The Chauncey Billups pull-ups.
Okay.
And then Jackie Stiles' footwork when she got to her pull-up from the mid-range. Probably the main ones to me.
Okay, I got you. Struggle is too strong of a word. I didn't struggle. But, like, I was trying to think through this question. Think of, okay, who classifies as a role player, yada, 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 that kind of thing. And then as I started getting into stuff, I felt like a lot of my early thoughts were just like things that annoyed me with certain role players. I was like, I need to find some.
Interesting.
I was like, you know, I need to find some.
Surprising.
I need to find some positive things. So like, if you want to laugh at me, Steve, and long-term dunkers can also laugh at this, and fellow Heat fans can get upset. The literal first thought I had was like how angry I was at James Ennis trying to dribble. And I was just like, hey, if you could literally put the ball on the floor a little bit, you are just a firm rotation piece in Miami, at least during that era of Heat basketball. And he just could not do it. And so like that obviously burned in the back of my brain on the bad end. But beyond that, very Heat coded, a couple of ones that I had. The Shane Battier, and this is more like pre-Heat with Shane Battier, but the Shane Battier literal in-your-face contest Let's think about the Kobe battles when he was in Houston, but that still carried over into the Miami Heat era. Like, I am putting my hand as close to your face as possible without fouling you. You're going to make this incredibly difficult for you. And then Mario Chalmers as a concept probably counts, but he did have just kind of smirk about him when he hit big shots in big games. That always made me chuckle. And then there was also like the pat the chest. This is my hashtag stuff after making big plays in Miami as well. So like those were some of the quick ones. I didn't want to be super negative on the podcast. So sadly, James Ennis is the only person getting astray in this segment. But those are some quick thoughts on some role player mannerisms and things that I remember. And now we have a couple of questions from our dear pal Parker, who asked, is Chris Paul on the Clippers just what Chauncey Billups on the Clippers was to Chris Paul's Clippers? Which, what a question.
I'm going to let you handle that first.
Okay. Well, you probably shouldn't have let me do that because I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole. And I was like, okay, well, let's brush up on the Chauncey Billups Clippers era, right? So I saw the base numbers. Year one as a Clipper just averaged 15 points a game. I was like, huh, I didn't remember the scoring volume being there. But anyway, 42 games for Chauncey Billups as a Clipper across 2 years. So that tells a bit of the story of Chauncey Billups as a Clipper. 11.5 points per game across those two seasons. Converted 38% of his twos, which is not ideal. Naturally, later stage Chauncey Billups did shoot 38% from three. So that part was cool. Then we looked at some of the on-off data from this era across these 2 years.
Oh, we went right to the numbers. Oh my god.
I'm trying to set the stage for this, right? I'm trying to set some expectations. So if you want to draft some water, you can. That's okay. But the Clippers were plus six. And Steve has turned off his camera. But the Clippers were plus six in nearly 4,300 minutes with Chris Paul on the floor without Chauncey Billups. They were a near plus seven net rating in 867 minutes with Chris Paul and Chauncey Billups sharing the floor together. And with Chauncey on the floor without Chris Paul, it was a minus 3.7 net rating. And so that brought me to last year's Clippers, where they were a plus five in over 3,000 minutes with James Harden on the floor. They were a plus three with him off the floor. And then that took me to the Spurs, as that's where Chris Paul is now coming from. They had a minus one net rating with him on the floor in over 2,300 minutes. They had a minus 5.4 net rating in nearly 1,700 minutes with Chris Paul off the floor. So about 4 points better with Chris Paul on. And so I say all of that to say, I think Chris Paul is better positioned to like take on some of the non-Harden minutes offensive ownership. In addition to him likely sharing minutes with Bradley Beal or Bogdanović against second units, et cetera. So I think that part is going to be better. I think Chris has just a little bit more, especially on the playmaking front, just has more utility to kind of grease the wheels on that front. And naturally, Chris Paul and James Harden have the history of playing together. And so in any minutes that those two share together, I think they will know how to kind of split the playmaking duties on that front and take pressure off of each other. And so if I had to guess, I think the Clippers are going to be better with Harden on than with Chris Paul on, just like directly. But I think they can play together. And I think the bench units are going to be positive with Chris Paul on and James Harden off. So to answer the question, Parker, no, I don't think this is the same thing directly. I think it's going to be fine. There we go. Now,
Chauncey was good with LA until he tore his Achilles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the crucial question is no, because Chris Paul's not going to start.
Ah, well, there you go.
And also, the Clippers claimed Chauncey off waivers and then traded for Chris Paul. Order of events, not the same.
Oh, see, there you go. And to the second one. And this transition to our W segment of the mailbag. Who feels closer to the best player in their respective leagues? Nafisa Collier or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander?
Well, see, here's the thing. Both of these players have a player that is always going to hover in their league. So does their best season get them that nod? I don't know. I'm going to go Nafisa Collier. Because in worst case, even the people that strongly believe Asia Wilson is the best player in the world would probably say Nafisa Collier second. Mm-hmm. the people who think Jokic or Luka or insert player here or insert Giannis other player here or would probably not be as willing to just put Shea 2.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go fee.
Yeah. It was a quick fee for me for that very reason. I was like, I think at worst fee is just kind of, I guess you can't say universally too strong, but like she is widely known as like top two. I think she has been the best player in the league this season. Like, I don't know if you want to give like 20 plus games, you know, as enough to officially give her the nod over Asia. You can, but like, she's been the best player in the league this year. I think even with Shea's MVP last year, there are a lot of people that would argue Shea may have had the better season. He's not better than Jokic. And as Steve mentioned, there are going to be Giannis folks and Tatum folks and Luka folks, which where you can construct legitimate arguments, not just to say these are like just player fans or whatever. You can make legitimate arguments if you even zoom out to like a 2 or 3 year sample. So I think Fee is just more firmly two than Shea is, if you even consider Shea two. So that is where I'm at on that front. Next one going to come from Josh, who says, "Dear Steve and Nikias, what do you make of the year-by-year dip in Breanna Stewart's three-point percentage? In each of the past three seasons, it has declined from the year before, and this year she's barely shooting 20% so far. The strange thing is she's shooting almost her best percentage ever inside the arc. Does this have to do with age plus past lower body injuries, changes in her role within the offense, or something else entirely?"
This has Nikias Duncan written all over it. What do you mean?
Like, this is something famously in Dunker Spot lore that has really confused slash bothered me. Because it'd be one thing if, I guess we can like use Fee as a quick example, to where like we've never had the high volume good 3-point shooting season for Fee. We have had this is solid, but it's on like 3 attempts or whatever the case may be. Like, we have like previous history of Breanna Stewart legitimately being a very good shooter on like moderate or moderately high volume across multiple seasons. And so for it to turn into 20% on 3 attempts, and this was the year before last, and you mentioned the 3-year sample, but like even just kind of tracking it throughout the history of the pod and the kind of conversations we've had off and on about it. And, you know, this, as Steve alluded to, this is my kind of question. I've been the one bringing this up. I've been tossing the question to Steve, like, hey, are you concerned about this? Do you think teams are eventually going to be like, nah, we don't care, yada, yada, yada. Liberty just won a title last year, so obviously it super mattered a ton. But it's been odd to see it transition to this. And then, like, you get to the unrivaled season. I was like, okay, well, maybe we just see it perk up there and we see the, you know, see her regain the confidence and stuff like that. And it's like, no, didn't shoot well in unrivaled either. And now we're having a career worst year. So, like, I tried to find some, like, let me look at the shooting form for Breanna Stewart when she was in Seattle versus what it is in New York, and see if there are any differences there and stuff like that. Like, I didn't see anything majorly different. I'm also not a shot doctor, so even if I did, like, I don't even know if I could, like, confidently say it on the podcast to feel good about it type beat. So, like, I didn't notice anything drastically different with the form itself or with, like, the arc of the shot or anything like that. The footwork doesn't feel super different. So honestly, I don't know. Like, what would make more sense to me is if the 3-point dip was happening and we also saw like a drastic dip in free throw shooting or something like that. And so I could at least make the, maybe there's something with the hand happening that we just don't know about. And the touch has kind of declined a little bit and defenses are pressuring her in different ways. Like, I can't even get that. I genuinely do not know what the deal is. Like, for me, this is kind of the W version of Andre Iguodala just couldn't make free throws anymore. And I still just could, I still can't figure out how that happened or why that happened. I don't know why Breanna Stewart just suddenly cannot make threes anymore. And at this point is reluctant to take them to the same degree she could in earlier in her career. So this is probably a bad podcast answer. I earnestly do not know. I've been trying to figure this out for 3 years. I don't know.
So does it still bother you to the same degree?
To the same degree, no.
Why not?
Mostly because they just have other players that can take the threes and they still win. And to the quick nod to the question, she has just been uber efficient inside the arc. I think for me, as we talked about Stewie on here, it was the combination of, hey, what's happening with the threes, and hey, Stewie ain't getting to the rim to the same degree either. Like, is this just the decline, period? But like, seeing the rim pressure perk back up, and again, the inside the arc efficiency overall perk back up, it alleviates my overall, I guess, scoring concerns with Stewie. And so, like, the three-point shoot, it doesn't have the same weight for me, if that makes sense.
Okay. While you were talking, I did some very, very, very quick math.
Okay.
Some very quick math. But I just think Stewie just started turning down threes. It said, let me lock up, and I don't have to do that anymore. You know, 2.9 attempts, career low. 6.6 free throw attempts, a career high. I think part of it has to do with the amount that she's initiating when she grabs and goes, with the spacing of the Liberty, with the kind of the talent level. Mm-hmm. Sabrina's rise to a degree, the ball movement, the way that offense has evolved. You know, I went back to 2023, right? Mm-hmm. 33.9 of her field goal attempts were threes. And that was very heavy in the please Stewie save us type beats. You know what I mean? 21.8% of the shots were mid ranges. 23.5 were in the paint, non-restricted area. 20.7 were restricted area. It has shifted to a lot of these shots that are in the paint, non-restricted area. Mm-hmm. 34.3 last year, 36.2% this year. She went from 24% of her shots in the restricted area, 30.8 this year. Mid-range has gone down to 12.5%, threes are down to 20.5%. So I just think it's, I don't have to take these. Mm-hmm. I'm not as willing to take these. I can get in the paint and do something with it. You know what I mean? Pick and roll, you switch, or you go under. I get a catch at the elbow. Yeah, I don't have to take a three type mm-hmm. beat. I push, I drive and attack real quick. I think that's kind of more the mindset. And, you know, with Sabrina having the ball, obviously Jonquel back, they just kind of play it a different way to where it's not necessarily as much as, hey, Stewie, pressure point, space. It's just Stewie be Stewie.
Okay, I dig it. I will say quickly to the earlier portion, where I was like, I tried to look at some earlier, like, shot form things with her, and I didn't notice any major difference. I do vaguely remember, I'm trying to remember which New York Liberty media member it was that asked Stewie, I think last season, about three-point shooting. And Stewie mentioned, like, working with, like, her skill folks and trying to get back to, like, the fundamentals and nailing those things down. So I do vaguely remember that portion. I want to attribute it correctly, so I'm going to try to find this before the end of the podcast so I can cite it correctly, but I do vaguely remember that portion. So again, won't completely rule out form things, but again, I'm not qualified to, like, make those kind of judgments, so I didn't really want to do that. But yeah, to your point, Steve, like, the approach has absolutely changed and has the ability, she has the room to change the approach because of the talent that she's playing with. So you also don't need those same threes. So I think that's also fair. All right, so next one going to come from Daniel. Daniel is back. Starts with year three. KT has been stolen. KT being Kayla Thornton in this case. So actually, to give a little bit of background, Daniel, across multiple seasons, has sent a Kayla Thornton / Kayla Thornton or Josh Hart question. And a Liberty / Lynx rank their wings type question for multiple years, right? And so we get to this season. And the question now is, you know, year three, KT has been stolen from the Libs and from this question. Rank the top five of the combined Liberty and Knicks wing room, assume full health, no leaving Benaja Laney Hamilton off of that tech, leaving Benaja off on that technicality directly at me, because Lord knows I would have done it. P.S. I feel awful how rude this question was to Kayla Thornton and the incredible year she's had. Please give her flowers before answering the question. See you next year. So we will be expecting this mailbag question at some point next season again. So quick salute to Daniel.
Yeah. Kayla Thornton, big piece of the Liberty campaign, all-star season. Let's go. Mine is OG Anunoby, Benaja Laney Hamilton, Mikal Bridges, Leonie Phoebus, Josh Hart.
Okay. This is kind of boring because my official order is also OG Anunoby, Benaja Laney Hamilton, Mikal Bridges, Leonie Phoebus, and Josh Hart. I do have in my notes, in parentheses, next to Leonie, the aggressive version is probably number two. If we are just going to get the Leonie Phoebus that actively hunts her own shot, we'll take contested threes, we get a little bit more of the post-ups in addition to what she's doing defensively, I don't mind moving her past Mikal or Benaja, because the defense is just that good. And there's a scoring versatility that I enjoy there. But as we do not get the consistent aggressive version, I had to slot her at four, but she's obviously very good and important to what the New York Liberty does.
Hey, Nikias, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you know how many times in the regular season that Phoebus has shot 10 or more times in a game?
This season?
Over the last 2 years.
Oh, over the last 2 years.
In the regular season.
in the regular season less. I'm going to say eight.
Three times.
That's, yeah. Like, it can't be that. I mean, it can be. Like, they just won, et cetera. But, like, for this exercise, I would like for it to be higher than that because she's good enough to do that.
Then did it three times in the finals.
That's fire. So I almost got to eight, so six combined last year. But yeah. I think there's room for her to be a little bit more aggressive. And we have seen that over the last few seasons.
Oh, buddy, no, that's six total. It's only happened once this year.
Oh, Lord. We ain't even got that. Oh, yeah, I need. Hey, Leonie, come on. Leonie slash Sandy, come on.
Let her cook.
So there we go. Next one going to come from Mel, who asked, as a current high school coach wanting to emphasize spacing and movement in half-court offense, which teams currently in the W execute this the best? Thanks, big fan of the pod and content.
Minnesota Lynx, full stop. Mm-hmm. I mean, that team goes. That flow is always there. They're looking for great shots. Always move the ball, always move their bodies. They screen, they cut, they space, they keep pressure on teams. That's the one for me. If you're looking to accomplish those things, that's the team you want to look at because they're at their best when they keep pressure on you and they use their movement to do so. You know, it's not just pick and roll. It's going to be a flare. That's another pick and roll. Now there's a cut on one side. You know, you never know what's going to happen. The next piece of the offense, they understand what they're doing. So the Lynx for number one for me. If you're going pure spacing, I'd probably say Liberty. When they go five out, four out, one in, they can use spacing to their advantage in different ways. Mm-hmm. I have a third candidate, the Atlanta Dream. Depends on your roster, but their ability to go side to side. If you have size in your team, if you want to optimize that size and understand how to kind of build around, okay, we need to create spacing, but we also need to have a flow. The Dream are pretty good at that when they want to be. So those are my three.
There we go. I like this. I like this question. I like that we have like similar but slightly different approaches to this. And so number one on the list for me was also the Minnesota Lynx. And just to quickly put the numbers to it, they are the best offense in the league this year. Best offensive rating, not only the highest assist rate in the league, but they are about – they are set to break their own record in assist rate at this current pace right now. So they certainly move the ball. They score well. And Steve already mentioned the spacing and the amount of pressure that they put on defenses. So won't hang there too long. I also had the New York Liberty on the list from the spacing perspective for all the reasons that Steve listed. I also had the Phoenix Mercury as a team that I wanted to toss out there. Let's talk about general spacing elements. You know, I am a fan of let's invert this offense. Let's let our forwards handle. Let's let our guard screen, et cetera. But they do a lot of fun things in terms of, like, we're cutting through to open up this different spacing look before we flow into some of these screening actions, either on or off the ball. They do a lot of fun there, and they do generally move the ball well. The wild card team that I wanted to ask you about, Steve. So I had two teams I wanted to ask you about. But, like, the wild card, and I like the dream shout from you. I wanted to bring the Sparks to the table. The face is getting... I think for me with the Sparks, it's very much, I see what they are trying to do. And they do have a level of versatility with their front court talent in particular that you can move them around. But they don't execute well enough. And so for me, it's very much like take what the Sparks are trying to do, but like actually hammer home the importance of screening and like half court tempo. And I think you get a good mix. But like, I think they are very much like the ideal squad for me, or the idea squad, not ideal with the L, without the L, idea. Idea team that I wanted to bring up was the Los Angeles Sparks. Based on the facial expressions that I am getting here, I would assume this is a hard no from Steve Jones Jr., which is A-okay. But wanted to bring the Sparks to the table. And the question that I had for you through this lens is where do the Aces fit in for you?
Depends on what they want to do. When they play like they did against the Dream, yeah. When they have flow and they play with tempo and they pass and cut and they move the ball from side to side and they keep pressure on you, yeah. You have a hub in Asia that can move around the entire court. You have guards who can attack in different ways. You have ways you can get to movement. You have ability to cut and keep pressure on teams. Yes. Unfortunately, they have not done that very often this season. I would like for them to do it more.
Yeah.
But at their peak of their powers, I won't say peak of their powers, but the ideal of what they want to do, if they did it consistently and had the right mindset, yeah.
Okay. The Aces were tricky for me because there was, like, throughout the Becky Hammon era, like, they've always kind of been in a low assist rate team, but because of the way that they space and because of the talent that they have, they didn't need to have, like, the five pass possessions because they would just put you in peril immediately. and then they just hammer you home. So it just kind of worked that way. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on like more of the concept than like the actual production, especially this year.
The Aces at their best was a team that knew they were going to put pressure on you, and they made you pay immediately. Hmm. There was nothing you could do about it. Every time you try to have a counter, you want to show help. You had to show help, two on the ball. Like they just made you sweat.
Mm-hmm. All right. This next one's going to come from Jamay, who says, "Hi, Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, I'd like you all to weigh in on the floor raiser versus ceiling raiser question for the Fever stars, Aaliyah Boston, Caitlin Clark, and Kelsey Mitchell. What's the difference between floor and ceiling raisers and where each of them fall?"
The what raiser against what raiser question? The what?
Floor raisers and ceiling raisers.
What is this discussion that's being had?
So I've seen a little bit of it on the timeline. And so I guess to answer the question, for me, a floor raiser is a player that kind of establishes, I'll say establish, I won't say guarantee because injuries, all that good stuff, but a player that kind of establishes a baseline level of competence / attention drawn. And so within this lens, Caitlin's on the floor, there's a set level of attention that she's going to draw. But I think because of the way that she passes, the way, and because of the scoring gravity that she holds, her on the floor is going to equal, you're going to generate good shots a good bit of time with her on the floor. So I would consider Caitlin more of a floor raiser. And I think you could have that on the defensive side as well. Like the old NBA comp, I guess I don't say old, but like an NBA, a common NBA comp on that front in terms of like a defensive floor raiser. You go back to like the Utah era, Utah era Rudy Gobert. If he's on the floor because of the rim protection, et cetera, at least during the regular season, Rudy on the floor, you are going to have like a top 10 baseline. He just deters shots, protects the rim, cleans the glass, et cetera, et cetera. And so Aaliyah Boston is not that for multiple reasons, but I think she is kind of like that floor setter for them or floor raiser for them defensively. Ceiling raiser for me is someone that doesn't establish that kind of baseline, but can take you over the top because of what they do. And so like Kelsey Mitchell, not a natural initiator, but playing off of what Caitlin does, et cetera. If Kelsey Mitchell's also giving you 30, you're kind of cooked. This is more of not necessarily the wild card, but like just that extra bit of that takes you over the top against the team, whatever. So I think within the floor raiser, ceiling raiser conversation, like I would say Caitlin and Aaliyah are both floor raisers. Kelsey Mitchell would probably be the ceiling raiser for me.
Why can't you be both?
I think you can. The best players are.
I'm trying to think, is what individual talent can really be a floor raiser? But wouldn't technically Lexi Hall be their ceiling raiser?
She can be, yeah.
If she's making shots and defending, all of a sudden that's a team and lineup that's really difficult. I don't know, man. I mean, I think Caitlin Clark's ability to get two on the ball every single time both raises their floor and their ceiling. But is it in conjunction with Aaliyah Boston's ability to finish an improvement short roll decision-making-wise? Mm-hmm. Or Kelsey Mitchell's consistent scoring? Does that raise their floor or raise their ceiling? I don't know. Well, why are y'all fighting about this? I don't get it.
I love the stages. What are y'all talking about?
I don't understand. Like, why are we saying Caitlin Clark alone is the Fever's floor raiser? Like, what if there's good defensively? Like, what is Caitlin or Kelsey or Aaliyah? What is the one thing they do that raises their floor every single night? I have a tough time with it in an individual concept.
Hmm. Well, that's fair.
Like, so I just think I'd put it in both buckets, honestly. Mm. If Aaliyah Boston is consistently making the right decisions and Caitlin Clark is getting two on the ball, their ceiling is much higher because we're going to punish you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think their talent as a baseline raises the floor of the team. Yeah, man. I don't know.
Fair enough. Okay, so I guess I'll quickly ask you on this front. So, like, is this the first time you're like hearing the floor / ceiling raiser, like, just as a concept?
Yeah, what is this?
Oh, okay. Yeah, this isn't new. I guess this is very much like a fan / media thing.
Yeah, I never... Okay. I can talk about a team's floor and team ceiling. I don't really think I've done it with a player.
With a player, okay. And to be clear, like, I'm not being like facetious.
I can see how a player can raise a team ceiling. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. You're going to figure it out if they have to go to the bench or they have to sit out.
I got you. Yeah, I think just like broadly speaking, like the ceiling raise, I mean, the floor raises for me are just kind of like your foundational pieces. Like who makes us on either end of the floor? And so that's a lot of your, like, naturally your best player, but like your best playmaker in particular, stuff like that. It's kind of how I've always heard it and thought about it.
Okay, then who's the ceiling raiser for the Atlanta Dream?
Ceiling raiser for the Dream, it's probably, I think it'd be one of the bigs. Like, it's probably BG in this case. It'd be like BG or Jordan Canada.
But if Ryan Howard and Alicia Gray isn't there making shots, isn't their ceiling higher?
It is.
I can't get jiggy with this.
He does not like this content. That's fair. But all right. Thank you for that one. Next one going to come from Twitter. This is from Stephen Omar 81. With Cam Brinks coming back, hopefully in the next few weeks, what do you guys think about the Sparks' outlook for the rest of the season? Is an improbable run to the playoffs wishful thinking?
Well, one, it'd just be fun to see Cameron Brink play again. I, in the back of my brain, have wanted to see what the defense looks like because some really good flashes last year. But also watching the Sparks offense, I wonder how much is Cam Brink just the glue that this offense is missing as far as being able to tie things together on that end of the court. Now, as a playoff run, well, I mean, they're two games out, I believe. So it's not improbable. The one thing I would say is, what an odd team. If they actually just won home games, they'd probably be in the playoffs.
Yeah.
3-8 at home, 6-6 on the road. So I wouldn't put it too far. I wouldn't put it too far out of the spectrum. They have a ton of talent. So it's just, can they piece it together? They're what, one as a recording, three straight. So no, I wouldn't be surprised. I would not be surprised.
Yeah, I think at this stage, and because like 8 through 11 separated by four games, or 8 through 12 separated by 4.5. We wouldn't include Dallas in this. Like, I can't get to improbable because there's just every team just has like 20 plus games left and they're bunched up enough. So it wouldn't be super shocking. As Steve mentioned, like, there is a lot of talent here. Like, I would imagine we just did the award check-in. I think we both brought up at least the names of Kelsey Plum and De'Erica Hamby for all W. Kelsey Plum's on second team for me. So, like, they have that high-end talent. If they're healthy, if they clean up some of the rotations defensively because they are an aggressive group, and for the love of all things holy, if they would set some darn screens, like, I think they really could do some things. Like, I wouldn't rule them out. Now, from there, if it turns into, like, you know, run 2D playoffs versus playoff run, like, if they get in at 8 and they got to face Minnesota, like, I am sorry to tell you, I think that is going to be a pretty short series. I think Minnesota's just that good, but in addition to just some of the regular season matchups between these two teams have not been super fun for the Sparks. But, no, I don't think it's out of the question at all that they can actually make the playoffs. So, I like the question, though. It's good stuff. Just in terms of the overall outlook, like, I've liked a lot of what I've seen from KP this year. Like, I've enjoyed the De'Erica Hamby season. I've enjoyed the Azaray Stevens season. Something that I was talking to a dear pal and dear pal of the program, Mark Schindler, about this the other day. Like, we're trying to figure out, like, where exactly Rekia Jackson is slotting into all of this, because, like, the usage has been kind of weird for her this year in the midst of all this talent. And so, like, I am curious to see, like, what shifts happened on that front in the second half of the year, if at all.
The only shift that can happen is she gets more second unit minutes. Mm. KP soaked up a lot of that perimeter usage. Mm-hmm. On top of the fact that their bigs are A, spacey, B, can drive.
Yeah. So you just kind of in the corner, big dog, attack, late clock post. Do what you do.
Continue.
So, yeah, like, I think just general blending of the talent is going to be interesting to track. We will see what the late game defense in particular looks like. Got to talk to Kelsey Plum about this during All-Star weekend a little bit. So that was cool. But I think they are a team that has the talent to beat just about anyone on any given night. It's just going to be consistency in little things for me. for them to actually become like dangerous team at the bottom of the playoff standings.
But that's okay. That's what I had on that front. Next one going to come from Anil, who asked, what should the Dallas Wings goal be this season? What would constitute as success for the Dallas Wings?
As of right now, just improvement. Build on what you found recently during this stretch. Understand who you are as a team. Understand what you can do. Form some sort of identity. Know what pieces you need and move forward. I think they've kind of struck a little bit of a balance. The Lee-Luisa combo, fun. Mm-hmm. Paige has been pretty steady. Arike is starting to find her way. We've had the youthful exuberance from J.J. Quinterly and Azzy James as far as their drives being able to fit in. Haley Jones at the four has been fun. Dejanay's back. So it's more so, okay, can we piece this together into something that resembles consistency? Are we getting better as the season goes on? Do we feel better about our compete level, our defense? Do we feel better about the offense? Does this now make more sense? That's what you want to end up feeling like.
Yeah.
So you can continue to feel like you're competing. Even if you fall short, you want to fall short because we're missing something or we didn't do this as opposed to what's happening. Yeah. I think they've worked to shift into that latter category more than earlier in the season.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I won't hang here too long because my answer to that question was literally just going to be like, just have a firm idea of what your foundation is on both ends of the floor. Like, I think it's well established. Like, Paige is the future slash face of the franchise at this point. But like within that, okay, what exactly are we trying to get to offensively? And what is the quote unquote hierarchy within our offense? What are we trying to do? What are we trying to accomplish defensively? And then from there, like, I think I watch Wings games understanding what they are trying to do a lot more than earlier in the year where, like, I loosely understood it, but I was just mad at what y'all were trying to accomplish. Like, we had a lot of conversations about the Wings just blitzing a whole bunch of people when they just didn't need to do so. So like, that nuance has improved a little bit. And so for me, the goal is, do we understand what we are, what we're trying to accomplish? And then within that, do we have a firm idea of which players on the roster we should be working to keep to build this next era of like Wings basketball? Like, obviously Paige is going to be there from there. Have we learned enough about what Azzy James, what JJ Quinterly, what Luisa, what Liu, et cetera? Have we learned enough to say, okay, these players are going to be in this next iteration? Or have you learned enough to say, okay, these players are not going to be in this iteration? Or are you in the I don't know stage? You just want a little bit of clarity, I think, is the biggest thing. Like, obviously, if they are 4.5 games out of the 8 seed with a lot of games to go, if the Wings push for the 8 seed and they actually make it, like, you take that as success for sure. If you have a playoff season year one of the Page era. But more than anything, you just want to have a level of clarity by the end of the year. So I think, and as Steve alluded to already, like, they're already on that path to understanding like who and what they are at the very least. But next one is going to come from It's Pop Not Soda 13 on Twitter, which it's soda, but it's okay. I would love to hear about your evolution as a W fan personally. Have you always been a fan of both leagues equally, assuming that's the case now? Is it due to influence / knowledge gained from working so closely with Steve? Did you have a favorite W team along with the Heat? This was in my mentions. So for me, my earliest W memory, or my two earliest W memories, was me as a kid. It was one, there was like a very specific W commercial where it always showed like the Lisa Leslie dunk at the end. I was like, okay, this is cool. But I was still more like at that point, like I've told the story before in terms of like actual sports love and stuff like that. It was like NASCAR first. Granddad was a huge NASCAR fan, still is. It was like NASCAR first. It was football second. And then a little bit of basketball was kind of the early order for me. And then a little bit of baseball on top of that. But that naturally fell off as the years went on. But it's like the Lisa Leslie dunk and highlight and everybody else that they showed. A lot of legends that I do not remember, unfortunately. But the Lisa Leslie dunk always stood out. Like, holy crap, that's cool. And then Backyard Basketball came out and Lisa Leslie was in that game. And so like that was my first experience, like, quote unquote, playing with Lisa Leslie on the video games, kind of understanding who she is. And then as I get a little bit younger, a little bit older, I was a big reader. So a lot of Sports Illustrated and a lot of Sports Illustrated for Kids. And in the Sports Illustrated for Kids magazines, they would have these player cards you can cut out and collect and all this good stuff. And so getting to see like like Cheryl Ford is somebody that I remember vividly, like reading about like the rebounding and stuff like that. And so like I had early knowledge of like some of the players, but like I wasn't a W fan wholesale. Like that didn't really perk up for me until Candace Parker hit the league. And even at that point, it was still more sporadic watching while knowing some of the like bigger names and some of the bigger college names that were coming in versus being a full-blown W fan. And so it wasn't until, Asia came in, and like there was the South Carolina connection there. She goes to the Aces. And it's like, okay, I have been trying for multiple years at this point to like become just a full-blown W fan versus being aware of it and enjoying the little bits that I see. Clearly, I can't just do it like this. I need to pick a team and I need to commit to the team, and that's going to force me to watch that team and thus watch the rest of the league and it kind of blotted it. So like the Aces were the first team that I like just started watching consistently. And the fandom and things kind of flown from there, honestly. Watching a bunch of Aces stuff. Naturally get into the media space, do a lot of Aces media things. I'm covering the league now, writing about them, reporting about them, et cetera, et cetera. So like that's kind of where it started. And so to like the team portion, like it would have been the Aces. They were the first team that I was like, all right, cool. This is where we're gonna start. They got Asia, they're new-ish. Let's see how this goes. Helps that they were also just very good very early on in the Asia era. But that's kind of where it started for me. And naturally, like getting to talk to Steve in some capacity every day for multiple years, like I feel I've become smarter at basketball, and thus I can appreciate more things about basketball. And thus it helps me with the league-wide coverage. Like I just understand concepts better. And so like I'm going to know, you know, even looking through like the team context, I'm going to know the Aces better than other teams, but like I can also recognize what other teams are doing and things like that, and kind of building the knowledge bank from there. Like it was a similar bit to the Heat, as they were the team that I latched on to as a kid. And so watching a bunch of Heat, you learn a lot about defense, and that helps me understand like the Raptors and the Grizzlies and the Spurs and on and on and on, because of kind of the foundational knowledge that I got from watching the Heat as closely as I was. And so it's a similar concept there. And like, I would probably say like the W and the NBA are probably on, they're probably on equal footing for me in terms of like general enjoyment, if not the W having a little bit of a lead. But like, I think they're pretty much on equal footing for me right now. And so there is the answer to that.
There you go, Nikias. I think my history is somewhere in the pod. For the interest of time, we'll just move to the next mailbag.
Okay, fair enough. Next one to come from JP, who says, hello. I have a question about free throw shooting percentages. Why do some players simply lose it? There's been a lot of discourse about how Russell Westbrook used to shoot 80% or so before cratering to where he's a liability. But then you also have CJ McCollum, who shot in the 90s one year, and the 80s mostly, and now shoots in the 60s and 70s. His three-point percentage remains good, though. Shouldn't free throws be a repeatable skill that gets better over time? What's going on here?
I mean, we're assuming that, yes, but you got to remember, like, free throws come at different times during the game. You're feeling a different way. Got to have your routine in order. It's a mental thing. Mm-hmm. You can just miss some sometimes. I think with CJ, volume for me is the thing with him. He's never really been a high volume free throw shooter. And so if you're in a scenario where, you know, you go 3 for 5, don't take one for a couple of days, you go 5 for 5, 7-11, you can just cut the math, just kind of get you into 60%.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't necessarily think it's a purely a skill thing. I think sometimes your routine can get off, you can get in your head, or you just miss a couple on that night and they kind of stack up on you. Mm-hmm. But I think usually the people who garner more volume or garner consistent volume are able to kind of stay steady to a degree.
Yeah.
It's because it's a part of their game. It's part of their bulk. If you're someone who, okay, one night you don't shoot free throws for a week, now you come and shoot 6. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to kind of have that rhythm and flow, catch your breath, let it fly.
Yeah. I think the volume piece of it, like sans like injury division or something like that, like I think the volume is going to be the biggest thing. Because like even going back to the Andre Iguodala example that I mentioned a little bit earlier, where I was like, I don't understand how you were this and now you are no longer this. So third year in the league, well, first 3 years, 74% on 2.6 attempts, 75% on 4.3 attempts. It was 82%. On 7.3 attempts. Those were both career highs for him. And then from there, like it was 2 years at about 6 attempts. Then it dropped down to 5.2. Then we're at 4.5. And then we're at 3.2 in his last year at Denver, in Philly. Then it's at 3.4 in his lone year in Denver. And then Golden State, he had one season where he averaged at least two free throw attempts per game. And that was just kind of it. And so, like, I do wonder if Andre Iguodala was, like, a more aggressive scorer, et cetera, getting to the line more. Like, does his percentages look better just by virtue of him taking three or four games versus, like, the 1.5 that he might have been taking in Golden State? I can think volume. Like, I guess I'll toss this to you, Steve, just in your NBA experience. Like, have you had a player in your locker room or locker rooms, et cetera? Like, have you seen them actively tweak their free throw routines at all?
Yes, 10 out of 10 would not recommend. Unless it's helping you. You gotta be careful with the free throw routine. You alter that thing, start spinning the ball, you're not a ball spinner, you're gonna be in trouble.
Understood. Yeah, I was just wondering, like, I think the loudest thing that I could, like, hear / remember is, like, player that we know is a bad free throw shooter and it's, like, insert Barry here. Like, why don't you just shoot him underhanded? And then immediately no, and then it's just nothing. Or then you get the random player that actually does take them underhanded. And it's like, oh, this is cool. And then it's a lot of people are like, nah, I would never do that, yada, yada. Then the conversation dies. That's kind of it. So I've always wondered, like, if we do have like, players in the league. It's something that I haven't, like, actively studied. Like, maybe that's, like, a research piece or something. But just how many players have gone from, I spin the ball, now I just don't spin the ball anymore. Or used to dribble it 3 times, now I dribble it twice. And it helped or hurt or whatever. Like, I'm sure there are cases out there that I just haven't thought super deeply about it and investigated it. So, that could be a hashtag idea to look into. But we have reached the final question, Steve. This one coming from Nick, who says, what's up, Nikias and Steve? First of all, thanks for all you've done and continue to do in the basketball space. Your coverage of both leagues is so thorough and insightful and funny. I'm a lifelong hoops fan, and I feel like you've changed the way I consume basketball. Well, thank you for that. Okay, now that that's all out of the way, serious question for you. What's your favorite hoop shoe of all time, either to hoop in or to wear casually? Keep doing your thing.
This is very quick for me. I'm not a sneakerhead. Never have been. Probably likely never will be. I have some cool Air Force Ones that I wear out on occasion. Those are probably the coolest shoes I have. But I wear Air Monarchs and have for years and will continue to do so. I had a size 15 foot since I was 15. And this thing is wide. So a lot of these shoes y'all like just don't work for me at all. Probably my favorite basketball shoe to hoop in is a Jordan shoe I got at UNLV my senior year that I don't remember what it was called. And I lost them in Hawaii, but they were flat. They were flat. And so they were perfect for my foot. A lot of the heavier shoes that people had or liked, they were just too heavy for my foot. I'm already got tree trunks for legs. I don't need heavy feet. I already have heavy feet. So probably the Nike Zoom Huaraches 2K4. Those were probably my favorite ones. To hoop in.
Okay. I like it. I had to, as I am also not like a sneakerhead, I had to like do some research there. Cause like, I know I had these shoes. I don't know which model they are, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the Jordan 23s that came out in 08, the black and red ones, had those that came out in 08. So I would have been 13 going on 14, I believe, when I first got them and hooped in them, and greatly enjoyed those. Also, like, black and red, my favorite color scheme, as basic as that is. And so, like, that immediately made me like them, but they also felt good on my feet. And so, like, those are probably the ones. I think the Jordan 18s, they had, they came out with, like, a Nuggets kind of baby blue color scheme with those I had. Like, those are probably my favorite ones that I've had, like, casually. We'll also, like, give some quick love to the A1s since I have a pair. You do have to size up on those, but if you do size up, they are comfortable and they are cool. And you mentioned Air Force Ones at the top. Like, I think we all at least have a pair of Air Force Ones, or should, before the darn bots and resellers took over and made them more difficult to get than they should be. I ran about down another pod. But those are probably the ones that come to mind for me. And with that, Steve, we have made it through a full mailbag episode. Any closing basketball thoughts at all?
No, we got to go.
Okay, well, fair enough. We've been hit. We've reached the time limit. So thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on socials at NakaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. As mentioned at the top of the pod, you can always send in mailbag questions, any basketball thoughts that you have at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Join the Dunker Spot watch parties. Come rock with us. Come watch some hoops with us. Come hang with us. We're going to be doing plenty of college football 26 things moving forward. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Our dear pal Matt has a 2K sim going at the moment, and it is topsy-turvy. I am very upset with what's happened to the Miami Heat in that world, but it's okay. We'll talk about it later. A lot of fun's happening. Link is in the room. Free to create a profile. Come rock with us, etc. And with that, we will catch y'all later.
Bye.